Dr. Meissner, real one. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Budapest, in Hungary, in June of 1936.
Can you tell me something about your family background, what your father did for a living and so on, please?
I came from what you might call a middle-class Jewish family. My father was working with my grandfather as a carpet merchant. My grandfather was in a very international carpet business, at that time resident in Vienna. And my father was fairly successful with a very pleasant life. My mother had her own business. Her own father was a printer, just 50 yards away from our house in the next street. And in the back of his printing firm, my mother had a small business of wholesale stationery. And we were relatively affluent at that time. They could employ a nanny for me, and they had a maid to open the door and a cook.
Did you have a religious or a non-religious upbringing?
At that time, I would say a semi-religious upbringing. My grandfather, my mother's father, was deeply religious, very pious and observing, and went to the local Orthodox synagogue a few hundred yards away. My mother took some pride in eating pork from time to time, which was a deadly secret to be kept from my grandfather. And my father at that time was non-religious, but he became religious later, after the death of his father in 1940.
What happened to the family in the war?
In 1941, when most Hungarian Jews had no problem yet, the Germans declared war on Russia, and they had already occupied Poland in 1939. And for reasons not known to me, they decided to deport all the residents Polish Jews in Hungary. And although my father was born in Budapest in 1902, his father somehow preserved Polish nationality. For no obviously no reason to me, but they found it convenient. And so on the strength of this, they were deported in 1941. And this was a deadly journey. They were interned in a place called Csatorai in Mihai, which is in northeastern Hungary. And they were fortunate that they were well off and they could employ a very good lawyer. And apparently Admiral Horthy, the regent of the country, had a vaguely Jewish wife. And they made a direct appeal to her. And they were allowed to return to Budapest after 3 months in this camp, this internment camp. And I understand everybody else was taken to concentration camps of various sorts, and nobody returned. So I was terribly lucky that they survived that time, and they survived the war. So by 1941, when no other people had experience in escaping, they were past masters at escaping. During their absence, I was staying with my grandfather. My grandmother had just died, and I think that I was an aunt of mine living with my grandfather and a cousin. And time went quickly, and my nanny was very dedicated to the kids. And I had this curious period of 3 months without my parents.
Do you remember it?
Oh, very well. I was just reminiscing with my cousin. I was 35 years older than I was, 65. And we weren't unduly unhappy, except that I didn't really fully appreciate the uncertainties whether my parents were going to return or not. I thought they were just some sort of extended holiday.
And then, what are your own memories as the war developed?
Well, I started going to school a year after this event in 1942, and I went to a school just next to the Basilica, to the main Roman Catholic cathedral of the country. And at the time, I remember there was a little German boy in the class. He was rather appreciated by the teachers, held up as an example of the stress of his being German. But otherwise, didn't affect us very much. I spent some time at some stage, again, when my parents on their rents of uncertainty, with one of my teachers who was teaching in the Foreign Mistress. And my nanny and I stayed with her in Buda, on the other side of Budapest. And my parents on the occasion visited her because they were feeling uncertain at that time. They were likely to be once more arrested and deported. But we had a relatively uneventful time right up to March 19th, 1944. Now, historically, this was an interesting time. The Hungarians were badly damaged during the war. And after Stalingrad, the Battle of the Don, and other battles, they lost very heavily. A lot of Hungarians died, and a lot of Jews were taken as assistant soldiers with them in the war. But I didn't know very much about it. Somehow life in Budapest for us was relatively quiet. My father served as a military auxiliary in the army, and as he was a clever businessman, his regiment used him as the chief buyer. He bought materials, mainly food and other things, for the regiment. He was very popular and appreciated, and certainly he brought the sergeant home quite often, and he had other friends. Jews were not fully recognized members of the Hungarian army. But he had a relatively good time at this stage, and he was fortunate not to have been taken to the Russian front, which was a very different story. And already these people were called munkaszolgálatosok, auxiliary soldiers, were very badly treated, and a lot of them died. But then, of course, so did the regular soldiers. But really, the big change came when the Germans lost confidence in the Hungarian military machinery, and they decided to occupy the country formally on March the 19th. And I remember I was in a cinema with my nanny, and just under 8 years of age, and there was this quiet for some shooting and things. And from then on, things happened very quickly. I understand Eichmann was installed in Budapest to speed up the implementation of the final solution for the Jewish population. And within days, we all had to wear Stars of David. Our house became designated as a Jewish house, that's a block of flats. And as we had three large rooms, in addition to the other usual offices, we had two other families installed with us. And lots of other Jews from non-Jewish houses were moved to the house. And suddenly things happened. It's an interesting time because the Allied bombing was accelerated. And somehow the house commandant was rather fond of me as a little boy. I was quite clever. And his wife made a nice armlet for me, which showed that I was the deputy house commandant. I was guiding along all the old ladies, that when there was an alarm, an air raid, we all had to go down to the cellars, and I was trying to help them, but what was happening is I seemed to be rather better informed than some of the older people. And we were half the time in the cellars, and that summer was fairly heavy bombing. The friend of mine, who was much older than I was, 6 years older, they were all going to little chemist shops trying to buy headache tablets and things like that that we should have a supply in case we have to treat our neighbors for pain. And they were all carrying gas masks. And we had these gas masks on our side and felt very official. It's an interesting summer, and the Russians were already in Transylvania and near the Hungarian border. The war was clearly lost, and yet it seems that the main task of the Hungarian government and of the Germans there was to implement the final solution, and all the Hungarians, Hungarian Jews were rounded up in the country and were taken Budapest, it took a little while longer. And we had a summer which was a good summer, I seem to remember. I was quite interested and pleased with all these air attacks because I was relatively important. And also it was interesting for communal life. We all lived on half the time in the cellars. And it was interesting to move on from a nuclear family, from just being with my parents and with my nanny, to suddenly live together with a lot of the neighbors whom I all befriended and liked. I wasn't really fully appreciating the dangers there were for survival right up to October the 15th, when there was a Nazi takeover, and I think they got rid of Admiral Horthy, who no longer was trusted as somebody who carried out the policies, and the Hungarian fascist government led by Szálasi was installed, and the Arrow Cross took over. And my father was terribly well informed in his army post, and suddenly a sergeant appeared in the house late in the evening with a bayonet drawn on his gun, and he asked us to go with him. He showed a little letter from my father gave him some money, and said, don't bring anything, you know, just a minimum or something, and he rolled us across an absolutely deadly quiet Budapest. There was some shooting here and there, and this was the night of the takeover by the Nazis, and he took us to his flat, which was near where the medical university is now, where Gülői Jut, where he lived, and his wife wasn't very welcoming, but we went there, and my mother and I were installed there to see my father, but my father obviously gave him money to rescue us. We didn't realize that we needed to be rescued, but next day everybody from our block of flats was taken away and taken to the ghetto or to various concentration camps. So my father was acting with great foresight in having us taken away from there. And then we stayed with the sergeant and his wife for some time. It's a small flat and fantastically comfortable, although they tried to keep us comfortable, but we had to keep indoors. Clearly, anybody hiding Jews would have been culpable, and they were careful for us not to be seen. After a while, my mother went away. She was to find some safe place where she could stay because she couldn't stay there for a long time. And the interesting thing was that I told you that my grandparents lived in Vienna for some time, and after the Anschluss, they wondered where to escape to, and they escaped to Poland, which didn't work out very well for them because, of course, the Germans went after them and they were there in occupied Warsaw. And my grandfather, no military causes, he died of blood cancer there and died. And my grandmother was there, and she equipped herself with some rather swish Polish papers and came to Hungary with the papers of a Polish countess. She was quite believable. She was a very elegant lady, always had her carried on beautifully, wore lots of jewelry and elegant furs and things. So she went down very well in Hungary as a sort of countess. And she bought herself a little flat, and nobody knew that she was Jewish. And my nanny took me to stay with my grandmother. But by that time I had the false paper of my granny's grandson. My granny was called Sarkarni, and grandson was called Sarka Tamás, and I was called Sarka Tamás. And I went to stay with my grandmother Meissner, who was having my name. And it's an interesting thing, but we seem to have got away with it. And by that time, of course, even there, we lived half the time in the cellars. But she was accepted as a strange lady from abroad and not Jewish. And I was accepted as somebody staying with her with a different name. and my mother found a place to hide, and my father was making an escape from the army, and he managed to get fixed up in one of those houses on the Danube, which was run by the Swedish Count Raoul Wallenberg. He managed to obtain from the Nazis an agreement that for money he could buy a number of houses on the Danube bank, and he could grant Swedish passports to Jewish people who were protected thereby with these Swedish passports. And these houses were crowded, and my father managed to get into one of them, and so he was hiding there. At the very end of the war, the Hungarian fascists didn't respect these Swedish passports and shot a lot of the residents into the Danube. But fortunately, my father became wise to this, and he left there just before Christmas, and he joined my grandmother and myself in the house where my grandmother was. By this time, there was heavy bombing. There was fighting in the borders of Budapest, and we were staying in my grandmother's flat, and we were liberated by the Russians on January the 13th. And I remember we welcomed the Russians, of course, with open arms. As far as we were concerned, the Russians brought survival and liberty. The Germans meant danger, and the Arrow Cross, of course, meant death. And so when the first Russian soldier arrived to the house, we welcomed him with open arms. By this time, the siege of Budapest had gone on for a month. It was freezing. The streets were absolutely full of dead bodies, dead soldiers, and dead others. There was no water, and the fighting went on from house to house. And I remember I lived very near to a big church, and on top of the church, on the cupola, there was a German machine gun, and the Russians had to work very hard on neutralizing that machine gun. And then the fighting went on from corner to corner, fighting with submachine guns, and I say the bodies were frozen dead on the streets. And we tried to walk out from time to time, partly because some of the houses had a water supply, trying to get some food, and we were living down in the cellars. I see we welcomed Russians with open arms, but some of the first experiences weren't entirely favorable, because although some of the soldiers, when Paul said to them, "Give me some bread," they gave me a bit of bread. But my grandmother took me upstairs from the cellars on the ground floor. I wanted to use the laboratory there. And, a Russian soldier came and asked her what the time was, and she was very proud to understand the language of Russian, and she told him. And of course, he promptly relieved her of her gold watch. She never quite forgave me for the loss of her gold watch and waiting for me outside. But having said that, what was a gold watch as compared with having had your life saved and knowing that you are going to survive? It was a slow time to move out of the cellars. People weren't confident that you could come out of the cellars. There were big posters that "be confident and come out of the cellars," but it took some time. An outbreak of typhoid and typhus in the ghetto and also outside the ghetto. And we were trying to take stock who was alive. And I was absolutely delighted and pleasantly surprised at age 8 and a half that I survived with two parents. This was a rare event for most people. Most people seem to have had only one, and quite a number of them had none. And I remember when I first went back to school months later, and poverty was such that a number of boys would appear in sort of ladies' shoes or no shoes. And food was slow to return. But yet, there was fantastic spirit, and we survived the war and were extremely happy. And some sort of business activity very soon appeared, and my father managed to engage in some, and I think it was moderately successful. Certainly, as I say, there was this dedication to living, and people seemed to be happy. Our house, where we lived, a big block of flats, modestly calling itself the Court of Napoleon, still there. beauty there. Style, very impressive. Three-story statues, marble staircase, and chandeliers. It was in a terrible state. But once it was left by the Jews as a Jewish house, it was occupied by the Iron Cross, who had their business there during the war. And then, on the strength of that, that this was an Iron Cross house, the Russian army decided to quarter themselves there. So when we went back after the Iron Cross vacated the house, and we put our things in, then straight away the Russians took it over. And then somebody set the house on fire. There was a big printing firm which had its stores in the cellar, so we had an enormous fire there. But we managed to put that out and managed to save our furniture. But it took us some months before we could move back into the house. We stayed with friends and relatives. And then life started. Well, there was democracy. I remember that even at primary school we had elections. We decided that fascism is over and we're going to have a democratic regime. And little boys like myself were elected to posts. And we all had our elections and we were going to be a democratic state. And this affected every, you know, lots of parties. My father supported one which called itself the Bourgeois Democratic Party, had about 6% of the vote, was led by a priest called Balogh Pater. And basically the first elections brought the small holding party, a kind of conservative party, into power with the majority of the votes. And a happy period. Communists and Social Democrats had each about 14-15% of the votes, and it seemed a happy time. And I think our life went on well. My father did quite well in business. By 1946, I remember he was sufficiently affluent that the maid that we employed had been the maid with the President of the Republic, Tilde, before. I remember his 46th birthday party in 1948 was a grand event, and everybody who came to his party received a jewelry as a take-home present. So these seemed to be happy times. Religious freedom was great. Jews were very obviously practicing their religion, as they were so delighted that they survived and that it was a free country and they could practice their religion after the oppression was. I had my bar mitzvah in 1949, I was 13, and this was a grand society event in the main synagogue, and being a reasonably clever boy, I held the service, what's called a maftir, somebody who holds a large part of the prayers, whilst others who have their bar mitzvah, yes, in a few words, a big party, and everybody was there. But interestingly enough, this was the time of the communist takeover, when to me as a 13-year-old boy, the only thing that became obvious was the prime minister of the country escaped. And it's unusual for a democratically elected government's head to escape the country. But this chap did, much parents. And then somehow there was a combination of the communists and the social democrats coalition. And from one day to another, the communists managed to take over power. No doubt it must have helped them that the Russian army was in Hungary. And somehow, these takeovers were taking place in all the neighboring countries which were under Russian occupation. So suddenly, from this liberal democracy, we changed to what was called a dictatorship of the proletariat. Initially, I sympathized with it. My sympathy was particularly great for it because about their first declaration was that religious studies at schools became facultative. You could opt out if you wanted to. And your parents couldn't veto your decision. And although I had no objection to Judaism, I didn't speak Hebrew and it didn't appeal to me to pray in a language which wasn't my own. And In fact, it didn't appear to me to pay at all, and I didn't particularly like going to the thought of a synagogue that my father visited with some devotion. And so I was delighted to use this new communist freedom of being able to opt out of religious studies. So that was my first step towards sympathizing with the regime. My father, of course, didn't sympathize. As a businessman, the shares lost their value, and within no time his small business was nationalized. Now this was a terrible event, because my father did his business in an interesting way to save the cost of keeping his stock in a storeroom or whatever, and he could conduct his business from a rather beautiful flat as an exhibition hall. He exhibited paintings and carpets there, and his customers came up and saw them exhibited there and then could buy them. But he used a pawn shop as his stockhouse, and when they came to nationalize his small business, they took all the pawn tickets, and they not only took all his stock of carpets and paintings, but even took my aunt's Persian lamb coat. My aunt by that time had left for Vienna, and she never forgave my father that this was part of the items which was nationalized. With all his wealth, everything was taken from him. My uncle by that time inherited my grandfather's printing firm, and I remember I was driving back with him to the printing firm, and they just took away his car. Now this was his personal car, although obviously he had it on the firm, and they just asked him to hand over the car keys and just pass the part of the forced nationalization. I remember the outrage he had. He must have been 50, that there was his personal property, his car, taken away from him, and all his business, and it was a total confiscation of things. And they really established a new rule with a vengeance. They thought that these people were guilty because they were capitalists, they made their money out of exploiting other people, and that they were fair game to have their property confiscated. But even at this stage, I was persuaded by the propaganda that perhaps this was a good thing, perhaps this was for the greater good, perhaps it was a fair thing to distribute people's wealth, and perhaps the poor were going to become rich. And at the age of 13 and a half, 14, I felt quite persuaded that this was a proper thing. And I remember my poor father complaining that everything of this was taken away from him. And I said, well, I'd be very proud of you if you become a lorry driver instead of a carpet merchant, and if you have an honest salary instead of making profits out of selling carpets. And it was interesting. I don't know why I imagined it. I'm surprised my father was so tolerant of me that I suddenly gave up on religion and felt sympathetic to people who robbed him of his belongings. Well, my enthusiasm didn't last very long, but I had two successful years as a young communist. I became, when I went to the gymnasium at 14, they immediately elected me on the school committee, which was quite grand because there were boys who were 15, 16, 17, and 18. And so at the age of 14, to be elected was